This series of Let's Make It Rain is sponsored by PensionBee, a leading online pension provider. They're on a mission to make pensions simple so that customers all over the UK can become pension confident and save for a happy retirement. PensionBee's website and app make it simple for customers to combine their old pension pots, contribute flexibly, and withdraw their pension money all in one place. PensionBee offers a range of pension plans for different savings needs, from a flexible self-employed plan to socially responsible plans like their Impact Plan or Sharia Compliant Plan. Head to pensionbee.com or download the app to get started and become pension confident. Remember, when investing, your capital is at risk. And speaking of investing, you've probably heard me say before that we are our own biggest asset by far, and that includes investing in the next generation. I wrote Cash is Queen exclusively for preteen and teenage girls to equip them with everything they need to take control of their financial futures early. It's been translated into 5 languages and is available worldwide. So grab a copy for you and a friend today. Hi, and welcome to the Let's Make It Rain podcast. I'm your host, Davinia Tomlinson. This podcast is for the rainmakers. Those women who are breaking down walls, building their own empires, defying convention and rejecting stereotypes. Women who are unafraid to have open, honest conversations about money among friends and to share the truths we've been told to keep secret. Don't forget to subscribe, share and download wherever you usually get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, then please leave us a 5-star review. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Let's Make It Rain podcast. Today, I'm pleased to be rejoined by the wonderful Samantha Clark. Samantha is a neuroarts design engineer, researcher and entrepreneur, as well as many other things. And I'm going to let her introduce herself more fully for you. Samantha, thank you so much for being here today. Why don't you give us a more expansive introduction for the benefit of the listeners?
Thank you so much for having me back. It's been really exciting to kind of see your progress, and definitely a lot's changed for me as well. So I guess when I was on this podcast before, I was a happiness consultant and change maker, and I still believe that I am elements of that, but there are journeys that I've been on since then, and I'm currently completing a double master's in global innovation design at Imperial College London and Royal College of Art, which is a real split between design, engineering, and technology. And one of the things that really inspired me about moving into this journey was I did a previous course on art psychotherapy and looking at that balance of neuroscience and art and how that kind of connects people. And so I'm really intrigued by how do things like the creative arts, music, our space really change our brain, body and behavior. And what might that look like when we think about innovations in the workplace, health tech innovation, spatial design? So it's kind of layered on to me making change in the workplace. But now I'm looking a little bit deeper at like what is actually happening in the brain and body in these environments, and what technology or products or spatial designs can we do to support people to be better, to work better.
I love that. And I think for anybody listening, and I suppose anybody that's followed your journey from Love It or Leave It and, you know, has watched your TED talk and seen all of the incredible work that you have done already as a happiness consultant, this would feel like a natural transition, a natural next step for you, if not, you know, specifically into the detail of that course, because I wouldn't even have known that such a thing existed. You know, this double master's in global innovation design and the way that you described it so beautifully just then. But for anybody else, they're probably quite surprised, and it probably looks like quite a departure from what you were doing previously and a real pivot. Can you share for us why for you this was such a natural and logical next step, and why you feel so unbound to previous incarnations of your career and what you were doing, and just you feel that sense of, as I say, that freedom to be quite fluid in your choices versus being tied to one way of doing things and one way of pursuing a career path?
Great question. For me, I guess prior to even thinking about happiness consultancy and change making, I actually did have a footwear business. And I think we discussed that the last time we're on the podcast. So I've always been drawn to creativity. And I was really missing that element of making things with my hands and thinking about how products and spaces come to life. I think post-pandemic, I was really questioning my career and what I was enjoying, the elements I was enjoying in terms of like doing the talks and nurturing people to be better. But I felt that there was a void in myself around my creativity and the areas that I was extremely motivated by. So really thinking about getting more into the arts, but grounding it in the psychology, which is, you know, something I've studied and infused into my work as a happiness consultant and change maker. And so looking at psychology and neuroscience, but through that creative lens. And I had an opportunity to start on a foundational year in art psychotherapy and reading a book on just how art really affects us, or how it can process trauma, or how we can think about what it does to change the brain, just literally set me alight. And I just wanted to think about how do I weave this into the work that I was doing? And I was already getting calls for help us think about our office design as we attract more people to come from working from home back into the office. What are some of the things that we should be thinking about in terms of people's well-being? And going a little bit deeper than just talking about company culture. And so I looked at opportunities to infuse this. And obviously the way that the world is going, we're moving more into technology, and I wanted those skills. And I came across this particular program on the way to see my mom. I was traveling up from Hove, and I came across this course, and I was like, oh my God, this sounds everything. I think I typed in, I was also really desperate to travel at that point as well. So I typed in travel, arts, science, tech, masters, and it popped up, and I was like, what is this? And it just spoke to my being. It spoke about strategy. It spoke about putting human at the center of the design processes that we look at. It obviously offered the opportunity to travel. So as part of the two-year program, you spend a term in Japan and a term in New York at Pratt University. So you get that real balance of the science and the tech and the art. And I was starting to see connecting the dots with the work that I already did, and then thinking about, you know, everything from office design and ergonomics, which is like the human factors we have to think about in the workplace. Like, what does it mean to sit at a particular desk, lighting, all of that kind of stuff. So it started to connect in my brain. I think when I was talking to others, they were like, I get it, but I'm also like, why do you want to go and learn about technology? Or do you need an engineering degree? And I just thought to myself, yes, I do. I'm curious about it. I'm curious about how things work. I'm curious about, not to say that I'm going to become a software engineer tomorrow, but I'm curious about how all these things align and how they're shaping and affecting us. And by weaving in that biological and psychological knowledge and thinking, how might that empower and maybe ground some of the future innovations, to me made sense. And so the transition that I'm feeling also aligned with the fact that I felt slightly empty a little bit inside with the work that I was doing. I felt questioning myself about my own levels of happiness at work. And love it or leave it is very much that process of identifying what do you really love about the work that you're doing, and what bits do you want to leave behind, and how do you start to make that happen? And I think that's what happened for me. I was just like, I want to make a change. I want to move into a space where I can be part of a design process and I can contribute to these areas and align with the knowledge I have existing. And I think that's what led me to this program.
Sam, there are so many gems, so many nuggets in what you've just shared. And even as you were speaking, I was feeling so invigorated and so inspired by what you said, because I think, well, there are a few things for me that leapt out. So I'm just going to reel them off in no particular order, right? But you and I are the same age. And I think there are certain misconceptions, if not preconceptions, about women when they reach a certain point in their careers, having achieved certain things already, achieved a certain level of success, maybe cemented themselves in their respective spheres, their respective fields, have a good bank of credentials, are well respected, etc., etc. Outwardly, you might be the model of success, the pinnacle of success in your chosen field. Of course, there are certain things that you are striving towards, because we are strivers, we are rainmakers, we're always curious about the world and about how we can develop ourselves further. But I think that there is this outward impression that we have arrived, and therefore we're now just on, you know, riding the crest of a wave. We're kind of plateauing in our careers somewhat, if not plateauing, because that can sound quite negative. But certainly we have achieved everything we want to achieve. We've studied everything we want to study, and now we are just reaping. There's nothing new for us to learn. We're just established in our careers. And what you are outlining and sharing, and this is one of the things that we have in common, is that there is no age, there is no point in our lives or in our careers where we can't just pause and say, I don't want this anymore. I want to try something else. And that's okay. Trying something else and pivoting is not for women or people in their 20s. It's not for people who just turned 30. And I know, you know, they often say, when people, whether they are men or women, you know, 30 feels like quite a pivotal age where people want to make some big changes. But past that point, you just settle for whatever is happening in your life. What you have always been so adept at demonstrating is that you are happy and actually you thrive on these radical pivots as you see fit, in line with the, I suppose, the vision that you have for your own life, which is to be curious, which is to explore, which is to identify new ways to actualize yourself. So that in and of itself, I think, is really inspiring. And I know from having spoken to other rainmakers, there are many in the community. And as I say this all the time, and it really is true. I am fortunate enough to be surrounded both in my personal and professional life by really ambitious, really smart women doing amazing things. But equally, there are lots of women who, again, outwardly look like the model of success, that feel stuck and feel like, you know, I want to make a change, but I don't know how that will be received by my peers, by my partner, by society as a whole. And so I'm just staying where I am. What would you say drives your sense of freedom, and particularly that freedom of expression? Because clearly, you know, at your heart, I suppose the common thing that seems to course through your DNA is that you're a creative, and how that manifests itself. It could be through the sciences and engineering. It could be through your writing, through your speaking, through the consulting work you do with companies. But ultimately, you are really a creative, right? And so it's almost, we kind of need to reframe in our minds what that looks like and how it can apply to us. So how would you encourage anyone listening who is probably equally as inspired, if not more inspired than I am, who might be feeling stuck and is secretly harboring a desire for a radical career or life change, how would you inspire them or encourage them to take the next step and free themselves from their minds? Because, I mean, ultimately, we're trapped in our minds, aren't we?
Oh, totally. You've raised so many good points there. Lots of threads I want to weave together. I think one thing is pivotal. Is I turned 40, I think, in the middle of the pandemic. I think it was, yeah, the year after, where we were still in lockdown. And I was really questioning the next 10 years, this next decade, what do I want to be driven by? And what are the things that I'm inspired to put out in the world? How do I want to support and help people? How do I want to leverage my skills in new ways? And that might sound all a bit lofty, but I guess these are things that I marinate on sometimes. But, and then I was also just curious about, where am I coming to life? Like, when you think about your heart monitor and where you've been flatlining, what are the things that really nudge you and make you think, oof, I want more of that? And so when I think about this sense of freedom, I think it's definitely something that I've cultivated. And maybe when you reach over this threshold of 40, you stop caring about lots of opinions. It doesn't happen overnight. Trust me, there was definitely still some concerns and, oh my gosh, you're throwing away so many years of like this, that and the other. And I'm like, well, I'm not really. I'm just switching what I'm talking about. And I think you have to really start to know yourself. So I am a manifesting generator. I know that sounds a bit woohoo for people, but when I think about my human design and the way that I live my life, I am meant to do many things. And I think it is that pathway of testing, experimenting, that brings me joy. The minute I feel frustration and stuck, I have to really answer that call. And so I would encourage people to lean in and sit with yourself in those dark moments and think, throughout my working day, when I look back at the past quarter, what have I really enjoyed about my job? What have I really enjoyed about my life? And I think this is stuff that I'm going to really enjoy talking about in my talks when I think about radical change and innovation, because we're in a time where nothing is slowing down. Things are only going to get faster. And you've got to identify, where are the gaps in your skills, your knowledge, your ability that you would like to plug? What other levers would you like to pull in your career to satiate an appetite that you have? And how can you start small? I'm not saying you need to do a big radical change. Like, nobody wants to, I'm not enforcing anyone to sign up to a 2-year master's, but I'm just thinking about what are some of the levers that you can start to push and pull with to give you some glimpse of the change that you are keen to make. How do you start to experiment in different ways and connect and research the risk too? Because as we get older, there is obviously financial risks. I am in a place where I don't have any children. I have managed to make a foundation in terms of buying myself a house prior to going on this program. So I felt like I had some of those fundamental Caribbean tick boxes, as my dad would be like, I want you to make sure you have your own place and all of this, and then you can go off and experiment. So I ticked those boxes. And so I'm very different to the person who might be listening to this and think, well, I've got 3 kids and my mortgage is... What is the smallest way you can begin? Because I would hate for you to sit in this place of doubt consistently, because it will eat away at your spirit and it will ripple into everything else, your relationships, the way you communicate, the way you be. So start to notice, what is the change that you'd like to bring about? What is the big projected vision? And how do you start to work backwards as a ladder? What are the rungs that are going to take you back to present day? And test, and also look at it. Maybe I am also in my scientific brain at the moment, but like, look at it as like an experiment. I talk about this in the book. What are the things, what's your hypothesis about this change? What is something you could test and something that you could have as a control in the background? And what measures are you going to be looking at on a day-to-day basis to purport the happiness or the joy or the elevated knowledge, the curiosity, the drive that you desire? And make notes on that. And then when you think, actually, this could be something bigger, okay, plot for that. Have the conversations with people in your life, your partner. If you are solo, then think about what other things are going to come out of this. Because, you know, sometimes with expression comes compromise or change. A big thing that came up for me was, gosh, everyone's really set in their careers and their partners, and will I lose all my friends because I'm often like gallivanting and they're just going to be continuing on, and are they going to miss me? Well, like, I'm going to be away for God knows how long. So lots of things will creep into your mind, but the desire has to be big enough for you to want to challenge yourself.
Sam, I absolutely love all of that. So I'm just going to, again, pick up on the themes. But, you know, when you said, of course, I love when you said, you know, be willing to kind of assess the risks, because we always talk in the Rainmakers Academy about calculating the cost of pursuing your dream life and assessing whether or not you're willing to pay the price. That's really important. But also being unafraid to leap. Now, of course, I am quite similar to you in that I'm somebody that's kind of calculating the risks at warp speed all the time. But I'm also somebody that's quite audacious in the moves that I make, because over the course of my life, I have become accustomed to winning sometimes, losing sometimes, but ultimately being willing to pay the price. And so I've made peace with that. I've made peace with that trade-off that, you know, I want to try this new thing. I want to explore that new thing. And I'm happy to just leap. I also have a really strong faith in myself and in my abilities. So when I'm leaping, sometimes I'm leaping with only 3/4 of the knowledge or 3/4 of the ingredients, but I always feel supremely confident that a parachute is going to emerge, always. And so on that basis, I leap. Now, the one difference is that, and so for anybody listening thinking, oh, you know, she talked about, you know, she's describing me, I've got 3 kids and, you know, my circumstances look different. I'm somebody that has 2 children, of course, and I've talked before about that on the podcast, but also the Rainmakers will know intimately my story and my journey from moving to London to this small island and doing so with 2 children who at that stage were very small. I mean, when I look at them now as bigger girls, and we were looking at videos of them last night, and I was like, oh my gosh, like, no wonder people were looking at me like I was crazy, because I was like, we're moving to the Caribbean. Now, from their perspective... It must have seemed like Dav has just picked up herself on a whim and decided she wants to live next to the sea. And so she's just moved. But actually, that was a 2-year planning process in the making. Now, of course, I don't need to divulge every step of every detail that I had to plan through. But what it meant was that, exactly as you describe, there were certain other considerations I had to make outside of just me leaping. And I think all of us kind of sit on a continuum in terms of our risk appetite and how much risk we're willing to withstand. It applies to our personal decisions, our professional decisions, and of course, our investment decisions and financial planning decisions. But from my perspective, a decision that perhaps if it was just me, might have taken me 6 months from, right, I've got to figure out how I can pick up my business and move it there at that stage. And in fact, even in the planning of Raincheck, I was quite clear in my mind, this business has to be flexible and it has to be digital because I don't know where I want to be in the world. So I already had that in the back of my mind. I don't want to be trapped by any kind of physical space or environment. I need to have full freedom. And that was prior to me, I think, deciding that I wanted to move overseas. But I suppose, you know, for anybody else that might be listening, thinking children are potentially going to block me from doing this, or I've got to wait until my children are 18, I want you to give yourself permission to just daydream a bit and consider how you might make that possible sooner than when your children are 18, if they're as small as mine were when we moved. I mean, my girls were 3 and 6. And just figure out the baby steps that you might take. It doesn't have to be a massive big bang thing. And exactly as Sam said, you know, applying that kind of science lens to it and saying, I'm going to test and learn. If moving abroad is the thing you want to do, maybe it's going to your chosen destination for a month. Maybe it's not staying in a resort. It's staying in an Airbnb where you can more familiarize yourself with the culture and the tenor of a place. You know, there's so many different ways that you can experiment, but ultimately refining through that process and iterating as you go. But doing so by taking baby steps. You know, we always talk about a baby step is still a step. So don't mm-hmm. feel like you've got a fully leap. You can just take a baby step, right?
Totally agree. I think the baby steps are what turn into, you know, every baby has to learn how to walk, and you do the little waddle and you might fall for a bit, but then that's essentially how you get to walking. And I think we don't give enough credit for the small incremental changes. I definitely had been marinating on this decision. One thing I would caveat was that seeing this course on the way to visit my mom, I applied the next day. I didn't even blink. It just came into my mind. And I was like, I will figure out how to make this happen because I knew I wanted
that
change. I knew I wanted it. And it just, every part of it just resonated in my zone. And I think I spoke to Natalie, who you've had on this show, and we went for lunch. And I said, I think I'm going to get on this program that's going to take me to New York and Japan. And she's like, yeah, you will probably. It was just a given that I'm going to apply, and I got an interview, and in June I found out I got on. I think sometimes there's also that sprinkling of if the timing aligns and it matches up, you've got to do it. Like if I sat on that and thought, oh, I'm not sure, how will I afford it? Da, 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 da. I mean, obviously the question of how to afford it was definitely there, but it was if I had allowed that to stop me in my tracks, I don't know where I would be right now. I think if I hadn't have applied, it was a now or never kind of situation.
I love that. And I love the idea of the stars aligning and then you being willing to take action. Because the thing that I always say, it's a bit like when we talk about money manifestation. And I remember a couple of years ago, we were kind of riding the crest of, you know, the peak of the money manifestors on social media trying to encourage people to sit and think about money, which is fine, I guess, but never backing it up with the action that's required. And of course, as rainmakers and as change makers, we also know that, of course, you have to get your mind right, but then you have to do something. It's not okay to just sit and think about something and wait, you know, almost in this really fatalistic way, and just wait and say, well, if it's meant for me, it's meant for me. Well, yeah, but have you done anything at all to actually demonstrate that you want it? Or are you giving, you know, if you are somebody that talks about the universe, are you telling the universe through your actions that you want it? Or are you sitting waiting for the universe? Or if you have another faith, maybe you're waiting for God to just drop it in your lap. Actually, we have to demonstrate that we want to do something in order for it to happen. And that is my fundamental belief. Others may disagree with me. Please let me know if you disagree, if you have an alternative way or approach that has worked for you in the past. But Sam, you touched on something. And again, this is something that can plague us as adults, because you'd think that by the time, and you're quite right, when you're turning 40 is so monumental for anybody that's younger than 40 that's listening. Oh my God, don't be afraid of 40, because it's just so incredible. It's so liberating. You do what you want. You wear what you want. You don't care. You wear your bikini on the beach without worrying. Oh my God, like when you're in your 20s, I would not have been caught dead in a bikini. And arguably, I was slimmer, and you know, you're 20. Like I haven't breastfed 2 kids by that stage. All this stuff. Now, like, you're just flinging it on. You don't even notice if anybody is watching you, right? Just turning 40 is the dream. But there is one thing that I think can plague us, and I don't know the point at which this ends. I'll have to ask my gran or my mom whether they still feel this as women in their 60s and 80s. The fear of what other people might think, the fear of what other people might say. And so I know that there are probably women listening in and they harbor these ambitions. And one of the things that's holding them back potentially is, gosh, what will anybody say? What will people say if I, you know, suddenly move from this to that? Will I look indecisive? Will I look like, you know, I'm not clear on the plan for my life? Or they know me as one way. And so if I change, particularly, imagine you've got a group of friends, really good friends. Now, I'm very fortunate. I've had the same six besties since I was 18. And we're very supportive of one another and, you know, all of our different evolutions. You know, we've changed so much in that time. And I've been through a number of life changes, perhaps because they just know how I am. And that's what I mean about being in a group of friends in which your quirks and nuances are celebrated, not just tolerated. And there is kind of loving challenge versus critical friendship rather than just being critical for the sake of tearing someone else down. But I do think that there is definitely something about knowing that you're about to embark on a big life change or a career change or whatever, and feeling like, oh gosh, I'm afraid to do it because I'm worried about what other people might say. What would you say to those people, Sam?
Great question. Do you know what? In the moment, I actually didn't even have that thought. I was just like, oh my God, I'm going to New York. I'm going to Japan. I'm going to be doing all these things that I had just been reading about in books. And then it hit me. I think once I started in September and I realized that I was with a cohort with people who were considerably younger than me and that I would be away for a good 9 to 10 months, I suddenly was like, oh my days, what have I done? And I was beginning to question actually the safety of, you know your friend, you know you're going to meet up for brunch, you're going to be doing this, and then suddenly I'm going to go from drastically having a lot less money and being in a space where I'm talking about things that perhaps they've just got no idea about or care to know about. And what does that mean for our friendship? And I think I have some incredible friends who were supportive, who were cheering me on, and yes, could offer that critical advice around, well, how does this fit into your existing career? How will you earn money? Like asking the right questions, which I think is really powerful. But I think you also have to know that balance between whose life am I living? And am I living for them, through them, alone? And how will you feel about that a couple of years from now when you've started to make choices and decisions to appease everybody else and you are still left empty, this empty vacuum? I think there is definitely companionship that you need for the journey, but it's finding the right people to talk to and it's finding the right doors that are open for you to converse with. And the people that love you and want the best for you will always be there in some shape or form. Your friendships will ebb and flow. I think that's one thing that I'm learning over the years is that there is different chapters in friendships and different chapters in our lives. And you might need to go one way to pursue something, or you might marry somebody your friend might not agree with, or you might move to a different location. You know, I have friends who have upped and left and moved to different countries, but they needed to do that. That was their life. And I'm lucky I can go and visit and celebrate that and connect digitally, but nothing's changed. Our friendship is still the same if we want it to be. It's a dual thing. So I wouldn't pause on your life goals and your life decisions because of a fear of what everyone else is saying. You just have to live it, because if you don't, it's you living with yourself day to day. And that constant narration in your head is not going anywhere. There's nothing your friends can do about what's going on in your brain. You have to appease that voice and you have to think about the challenges. And if you are pursuing another direction, you have to fortify yourself for the changes that are going to ensue, because they will. When you make changes with anything in life, if you add a little bit more salt to a recipe than is needed, it's going to taste different. And when you start peering off into a different direction or you start doing different things, things will change. It's how you navigate that change, how you communicate it, how you ground yourself in that change. That's important.
I love that, Sam. And you know, the line that resonated the most for me was, you have to live with yourself. that internal narrator that we all have. I mean, I feel like I'll be walking around Saint-Kitts sometimes and I've got the narrator in my mind, like giving a little, you know, just giving a soundtrack to every move I make. And like, it's quite entertaining for me because does anybody remember Ally McBeal? I feel like a Caribbean Ally McBeal at times, because I'll be walking around and I've seen things. And sometimes I'm like chuckling to myself based on these crazy things that I've conjured up in my mind. So, but ultimately, we all have to live with that voice in our minds that will say, are you sure you shouldn't be doing X? And it doesn't matter how many times, it's like pushing it down, trying to shove it back into the box. And this jack in the box just keep continually popping up. So we're going to have to confront it at some point, and we don't want to confront it at the end of our lives as regret. We want to be able to deal with it up front and treat it as adventure and treat it as opportunity, whilst recognizing that it's okay to make a mistake and it's okay to turn back and say, actually, that wasn't for me. So, you know, surrounding yourself exactly as you described, fortifying yourself, but knowing the people around you could be part of that fortification, but ultimately it has to start with you. And I think that's the, you know, brilliant message. So thank you. So I want to get into your studies a little bit, because from my personal perspective, this is purely selfish. I am very interested in the art of play, because I'm somebody that is generally quite playful anyway, but I've been reading more and more about adult play and really the reality that it's something that many of us lose when we move from being children into adults. And hence why we're always so delighted at those corporate away days, aren't we? If you work for a company and they have the team building and they're like, oh, let's do adult Jenga or let's do adult Twister or whatever. Everybody's so delighted, or let's go on, I don't know, let's have a bouncy castle, whatever it is. It's because we've lost the art of play as adults. So whenever we get the opportunity to be childlike again, seemingly childlike, we grasp it with both hands and we're excited to go back home and tell our partners or tell the children what we've done in a day. And the children are always like, what, mom, you play? Like, how? Why is it so important that we reclaim the art of play in our lives as adults? Because for me, like as I say, I'm walking around like Ally McBeal. So for me, I don't need anybody to tell me how to play. I'm constantly seeking out ways for that, you know, these unconventional, quirky pops of joy in a day. But I do think the vast majority of adults really just think their entire existence centers around family and home, work and money, and then they try and squeeze in a bit of leisure. So the leisure is a squeeze in. And even then, it's kind of a grudging kind of, I don't even want to do this, but I'm in my 40s, so I feel like I've got to exercise, for example.
Yeah, such a good point. Do you know what? I think there is something about just not allowing yourself to get rigid. Fundamentally, as we age, we are getting more and more stiff, right? If you don't exercise and you get up in the morning, your bones will tell you something, you need to get on it. And I think the ability to play, to experiment, to be curious with yourself is something that we need to keep hold of as we get older. It's given to us at nursery, and then suddenly things become very serious. Get a job, get the responsibilities, buy the house. You should be married by 30. I can see this also with my peers on my course. You know, they're all at that pivotal 30 stage. I need to get married. I need to have kids soon. And then it's a rhetoric that we have fallen into, I think, in society about what life should look like and how we end up taming our spirit and our bodies because of fear. I think we can't afford not to experiment with life. You know, we've been through a pandemic. There's also, you know, global wars at the moment. Lots of people are losing their lives on a daily basis. And you have one life. Are you happy to allow it to succumb to burnout and boredom and just an inevitable kind of humdrum? If that's for you, fantastic. But I know that it's not for everybody. And if you feel that whisper, it's important to invigorate your mind and your brain in new ways. So what other things could you trial and test? Is it a new way of walking to work? Is it a new recipe? Is it trying out something new on ClassPass? Is it thinking about joining a meetup on that random hobby that you kind of think you're interested in, but you're not sure about, and just go and meet a new set of people? The more you start to have new conversations, the more you realize the world is much bigger than this zone of interest. I don't know if you've seen that film, but there is that just, I think we have to be open to seeing beyond the blinkers. And I think this happens in these cities. Like traveling to Tokyo and seeing their approach to community, to creativity, to nourishing their bodies, to replenishment in that way. Don't get me wrong, there is also a dark working culture too. And I think that when you have such polarities as well, we can end up with some concerns. But I did notice there was a different zest for trialing and testing. And then you go to New York and there is the immense pressure and the pace of the city that means that you've got to kind of keep up. And if you're not working in a certain way or doing a certain thing, you're going to get left behind. And so we have to navigate where we are, where we're living, and what that pace is, and whether or not that pace is right for your rhythm. And what can you do to reinvigorate yourself on a consistent basis? Because we have to. And if we don't, I think if we don't invite an element of experimentation, iteration, trialing and testing, you're not going to really know the capacity of you. And that's one thing I'm really appreciative of, like studying at the moment. Like when we're in the studio and I go in and I just see people, like you've got one person playing with like resin, some other person trying to, you know, bend or make new materials from a wood hybrid. Another person's looking at AI and women in the workplace. Some other person is looking at like, how do we kind of support people who've had strokes and like come up with ideas to support them to cook. There's just so many different ways of being and conversations that I am excited to have and share. I might not need to do anything with that, but it's just opened up another part of my brain. And if we don't use it, our brain, we lose it. And we're already in a mindset and a culture of just scrolling and swiping and forgetting. And I listened to a really good podcast with, is it James Quick? The brain guy. And he was talking about the brain degeneration that's happening through our own inability to be different or to try new things. We're just getting more and more and more stuck. And the less you're using of your brain, the less it's like required to do anything for you. And so therefore we end up with more and more rates of Alzheimer's, more and more issues around just being able to recall phone numbers. So it's imperative that you do actually try to re-engineer your lifestyle to boost your brain and your body so that you can be responsive to the changes in life, but also to kind of keep yourself refreshed and nourished and with that vitality. I think it's really important. Otherwise, we just end up feeling a little bit like clones of ourselves, just operating on autopilot. And that's just no way to live, really.
Not at all. I mean, even as you were speaking, as somebody that is so, I don't know, I throw myself into new adventures. I've always been that way, even as a child. The idea of being stuck terrifies me. And I'm sure that in my psychology and my makeup, there is something about that it's okay to be still. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't, all, you don't always have to be on an adventure. But, you know, I thrive on adrenaline. I thrive on, you know, exciting experiences and diverse experiences. And I can see how people that maybe don't embody that characteristic from their perspective, they're looking at that might be terrifying. For me, it's terrifying to be stuck. To them, it's terrifying to constantly look like you're on an adventure. But I definitely think we do need to give ourselves the permission to explore and to, and exactly, give into play, feel like, you know, because ultimately that's all it is, isn't it? You know, as children are playing, they're finding out things about themselves and discovering the world in creative ways.
Exactly. Through touch, through colour, through sight. Yeah.
Touch. And yeah, we are just experimenting, really, and we give them the freedom to do that, but we need to give ourselves the freedom to do that, because actually often it is us putting the handcuffs on ourselves. It is us putting the straitjacket on ourselves. And then, you know, I often talk about personal responsibility with the Rainmakers, because again, even in the context of some of the financial challenges we face, we know that there are a number of them. But what are the things that we can do to unshackle ourselves in terms of our approach to our money management, for example? What are some of the ways that we are self-sabotaging? Not even, you know, with an awareness that we're doing it. So I think an ability to just notice what's happening and look for patterns or clues in our own behavior, that should be the start point for everything. You've talked about, and this is one of the things that I love most about your program, the opportunity you've had to experience life in different cultures across different time zones in different parts of the globe. And of course, whoever put the programme together, they would have been very deliberate about where they chose in the world for you to see those contrasting ways of life, ways of work, ways of just being. What did you uncover about those different environments, and you know, how did they shape the way you view our approach to work and life? Because you kind of touched on the contrast between Japan and New York. How would you say, you know, how do they contrast with how we approach life in the UK, for example?
So when I landed in Japan, I'd been before, but I think this is the first time I was able to be there and really embedded in the system. So there's lots that's fascinating about Japan, and there's also lots that was quite irritating as well. But I think that's the same in any country. But I think the one thing that I love there is it just felt very peaceful. It just felt very safe. You're not on tender hooks worrying about the fragility of your life there to a certain degree. And I think, you know, when we are living in cities like London and New York, I remember the vast difference of landing in New York and the noise, the dirt, the intensity of the city. I was just very overwhelmed coming from, I had to do a quick pit stop in London, but then just the difference. In Japan, I felt that there was the spaciousness to really take care of yourself. It's a prioritized thing. Like every Sunday, we would go to the onsen, which is like their public baths or whatever. And you would see the generations together. So grandma, mom, daughter, bathing, conversating, and just that renewal, that invitation to kind of renew yourself. I love the collectivism and the community and that sense of resilience. I think Japan's quite a resilient country in terms of what they've been through historically. They are quite out and removed from the world in that sense. And it's a very insular country as well. So I think there is that protection of language and culture that can be quite alienating as well for an outsider, because even after 4 months, you still are not Japanese. So it's kind of, well, not that you would expect to be after 4 months, but what I'm saying is there's still a measure of like, you are a foreigner and this is our country kind of thing, which I thought was really fascinating. I think the work environment there definitely needs some change. And I think they're going through an issue where there isn't enough innovation coming from younger people. So they are starting to invite more foreigners into research positions. So I noticed what happens in a country where there is very stagnant leadership, and this is the way it's always been done. We're not interested in changing, and where you can get stuck. So there's a lot of innovation happening in certain parts. And then fundamentally, the bureaucracy and the way that things are set are still quite rigid. And I think that might change over time, but it's whether or not the youth are engaged with pushing through some of those layers. And then when I moved to New York, I felt the pace was just very different. You can tell the difference in maybe a more individualistic culture. I did worry about the lengths of poverty and mental health. And you can see that in terms of the way that people work as well. It's very fast paced, work hard, play hard. And I think you have to be. It builds a certain armor in the city, because if you don't, you're going to fall off track. And then falling off track means no healthcare, nothing. I went to go and work at a shelter, and I met this guy who in the space of a year had lost house, wife, everything, just from falling sick and being behind on medical and then losing job. And it's just a very quick decline. And so that's one thing that, although the UK has its concerns, if you get run down in the street, an ambulance will come and get you. Whereas in New York, we had a story of a girl who had an epileptic fit and they called the ambulance, and that was, you know, a good $5,000. Now she has a notice, I'm okay, don't call an ambulance kind of thing if I have a fit. So it's a lens that you need to go to protect yourself. It's very much a can-do attitude, because you must do to survive. I'm not entirely sure my pace is wired that way. You know, I'm also realistic. I'm in my 40s now. And whilst I'm sprightly and energetic, I think that pace after a while might wear me down. I did a lot of work traveling between New York and LA, and I think I'm definitely more that chilled West Coast life, but LA also has its own variances and differences. But I think I learned a lot about design and what's important and the way that things are crafted and attention to detail in Japan. And in New York, there was definitely the cultural element, you know, being able to explore the music and the scene and the food. It really helped to fortify me as a designer, as somebody looking at the way that our products and spaces inspire us. So I took courses on sound design, landscape architecture, medical device design.
And in Japan, it was very much around robotics and VR and that kind of thing. So I can start to see how some of those innovations are shaping the workplace too.
Gosh, just in that, I feel like the entire podcast could have been on the the contrast between Japan and New York, because I had a recent trip to New York and I remember feeling, particularly as somebody that spent 20 years in London, and I love that pace. And of course, working in the city, working in finance as well, it's compounded. You know, you are just used to the relentlessness of it all. And as you say, the work hard, play hard. But that was one of the things that I craved about island life, the complete contrast. And of course, for me, it's a bit like, imagine a train going 100 miles per hour and suddenly having to go to 5. That literally was my experience. And it's something that I'm still working through almost 4 years later. The change in pace. I'm naturally somebody that works at pace. I'm very impatient. I'm very impulsive, clearly. But I'm somebody that moves at speed. I make my decisions at speed. I don't spend weeks and weeks deliberating on things. And I admire, you know, I've got one of my besties is somebody that really is very slow and considered in her thought making, her decision making process. And I am just somebody that can go through all the stages very quickly and make a decision. But being on an island where they move at their own pace and they do things very differently has forced me to confront some of my own behaviors and actually how they just were no longer serving me. And so when I first moved here, I was the person. People would see me and they'd be like, why is that English woman moving so fast all the time? And if they would ever see me stopped somewhere, they'd say, where are you always going in a rush? And I remember one time I said to this man, you know something, I actually don't know. I'm just so used to that. I'm used to moving at pace. And he's like, slow down. And so here we have one of the local beach bars. Its slogan is rush slowly. And I love that because we all need to embody and adopt a bit of rush slowly into our existence. But you know, what you shared about New York, I mean, it's terrifying to me, particularly on the healthcare side of things. But I suppose from your perspective, being able to identify what's good about those kind of different cultures and ways of working, the collectivism that you identified in Japan and in New York, and how they can actually help us in different ways. But it's almost like having tools in a toolkit and being and knowing when to take which one out and thrive in those environments. I think that's really key. So, Sam, you've shared before, you know, some of the concerns of others, you know, we've touched on this, you know, how your friends helped you to kind of go through that process in your mind of, you know, being clear on how you're going to support yourself. What is the actual roadmap to making this work? But one of the concerns you had was around your healthcare. And you've shared before in newsletters about having sickle cell and how you might manage that away from home in terms of being able to get access to medication and support if you should need it. How did you go through a process of kind of neutralizing those fears in your mind or putting in place a plan that would get you so far, but also knowing that part of it would still be unknown?
It was a very methodical, I think that's the one time that I haven't been impulsive, because I definitely took a step back and thought, okay, each of these places have different issues. I go to Japan, nobody's really going to know about sickle cell. It's not a well-known disease there. There is a language barrier. And so, you know, also to get into the country, I had to supply all the details of the medication. So it was really taking a step back and thinking, okay, what am I going to need to prepare for? So I need my meds. Within my circle of friends on my course, I was able to pinpoint the key ones that would, if I had a crisis, I wrote out a very lengthy email of like, this is exactly what you need to do. If I am I'm suffering from these symptoms, this is what you need to say when we go to the A&E. These are my meds. This is how I might look or appear. These are the signs. So I wrote a very long email and I spoke to them all individually about the risks or things that might happen. And then I also spoke to the university, and there was an actual medical center within Keio University in Tokyo. So I was able to kind of get some assistance there. There was a couple of people who spoke English. But luckily in Japan, I was very well. Like, not, I think it's also food, environment. Yes, uni was quite intense, but I think we also had lots of spaciousness to play. I was eating really well. And so that was fine. I think the anxiety came for me when I got to the States, and I again did the same thing. So I was traveling with most of the same people. So that was the case. But there, obviously, we had insurance from our uni, but I think there's still the issue of like paying out for that before, and then you would get refunded back and you just don't know. And I did have a crisis in September. I think I'd gone to do a rowing class and I may have just squatted a little bit too low or just not had enough water. And the panic when I was leaving there and I could start to feel the pain, and I just thought to myself, please do not go from 0 to 60, because I cannot be, I just can't, I don't want this hospital experience. I don't know how it's going to pan out. And I just cried with my friend, and we went back to the flat and she was like, what do we need to do? So she just bought like a ton of coconut water, loads of water. She lifted me into bed and I basically just rode it out with painkillers at home. And she was like, if we have to go to the hospital, we're going. Don't even try and like, because I know in your email you said that you're going to try and ride it out, but we're not going to do that. And thankfully, like after 2 days, I was okay. And like our uni kind of connection point was really great. But I think for me, the anxiety was real in the States, just thinking, gosh, what might that look like? So you can prepare and then, you know, the universe unprepares, or like you can have the plans and then things just go. But apart from that, after that, I was well. I think one of the key things that I definitely put money aside for was my supplements, making sure I ate well and thinking about fitness or movement whilst I was away. Obviously, I didn't get to do the kind of continuous spa thing in Japan because it's very expensive in New York. But so that definitely left behind. But I think, yeah, I was very particular about what am I going to need? Who do I need around me? What's worst case scenario going to look like? And how do I plan for that as much as I can?
Yeah. And I love what you say about the methodical approach that you took, because, of course, you know yourself, you know your body, and you have lived with sickle cell. So understand some of the different scenarios that you might encounter. And for any of us, whether we are sickle cell, whether we have sickle cell or not, it's kind of planning as much as you possibly can and controlling as much as you possibly can. And then, you know, taking those calculated risks that we all have to take in our lives. And so I think that's a, you know, that's an important message for us, because, you know, we've talked throughout this episode about leaping and waiting for the parachute, or being adventurous, or leaning into the unknown. But in this case, and there are other cases that I'm sure, you know, we will confront in our lives, where actually you do have to have a planned approach. It's not even for me. You know, I hope the message that I'm giving to people is not just leap without a parachute. I'm leaping with my parachute. It's just that my process of going through those stages might be at pace versus somebody that takes a longer time to go through those stages. But it is incredibly important that still we go through those stages nonetheless, and that we are willing to decide, are we willing, on balance, am I willing to take the next step? So thank you for sharing. And Sam, you know, we're just coming into the last segment of this episode, which has gone really quickly, really, really quickly. But I think, you know, something that I often think, and I have this conversation with my sister, who is a young, busy exec, and often she feels frustrated that, in contrast to perhaps colleagues or friends that may be mothers already, I think there is this assumption that because she's a young single woman, out in the world, you know, living an arguably very glamorous lifestyle, she has the freedom to do what she wants to do, to travel, she's got a beautiful home, has a beautiful car, all of the trappings of success, right? And I think people can assume, well, it's easy for you. What is there to, you know, there's no work-life balance because it's just you. You know, you don't have children, and therefore, you know, you're not married yet. So actually, what have you got to complain about? And it feels like there's this constant wrangle between those of us that are moms, those of us that are wives, versus those of us that, you know, arguably what society would describe as, well, you're footloose and fancy free. Obviously, that's not the case. So from your perspective, as someone that already had an incredibly busy and full life, you were running a business, you were an author, you were a public speaker, how did you manage that transition from doing all of the things anyway and being at capacity in your London life to suddenly now adding in, because you didn't necessarily get rid of those other things, you're adding in working across time zones and still maintaining this public speaking presence during your studies? How did you do that?
Yes. Do you know what? I don't know. I think it all just came together. I think in some ways, before I left for Japan, I basically planned out how I was going to continue marketing myself and getting the speaking gigs and the kind of licensing opportunities. And really, I knew that New York was going to be quite intense because there were quite a lot of opportunities I'd lined up in LA. So it meant flying back and forth every other weekend, roughly. What I didn't really plan for was the intensity that this last term would bring. And it has gone from naught to like 160. And so there has to have been some space that has been made in terms of I'm not working as much at the moment. And there's been some sort of plan for that. I will be revving up again from like July, but I think there was definitely some space I needed to make to be able to complete this thing. Because I think, you know, I'm not taking 2 years out of my life to then not do well. So I think there's been a conscious decision to be like, right, you're not going to be earning as much as you were last year. Cut your coat according to your size and just bed down for a little bit and then come out the other side and start, you know, rebuilding, remarketing yourself, whatever that might look like in terms of work-wise. I think you have to just really be mindful of this thing called balance. And I think what people don't understand is that when you are on your own, yes, it comes with all the frivolity, but who is there backing me up in times of crisis? Yes, I have my friends and their family, but fundamentally, I have to be the one to cut the check, or, you know, I need to self-motivate myself. I need to make sure I've prepped, meal prepped. I need to, it's a lot. And there are definitely situations where I've seen friends who have partners and they're deciding to start a business, and the support you get when knowing that someone's got your back, should you not be able to make rent this month, should you not be able to get your groceries, there's somebody else there. I think there's some power in having that unity and that connection. And I love the life that I have at the moment. Yes, I definitely would love a partner to join me on this journey, the right partner. But I am aware that it's not all smelling roses. Sometimes it's tough. And I think those moments where you have to go through it, people don't realize, they just kind of talk about the glorious side of it as well. But there are moments where you're questioning, you know, why am I doing this all on my own? And what's that unit when you close the door? It's you. So it does take a level of resilience, a level of fortification, a level of strength. And there's some things that have to fall by the wayside. You can't do it all.
I think that's the perfect response to that penultimate question, because I think, you know, in this perpetual, seemingly eternal debate for women about, can you have it all? I mean, why is it a debate just for us? I mean, anyway, but in that eternal debate about whether or not we can have it all, I love you saying some things have to fall by the wayside and that's okay.
Yeah.
That is quite and
knowing,
okay.
Knowing yeah. that the universe has your back, or that things are going to, I think manifesting and being in that mindset that things are always working out for me, even though on the surface yes. it might look like I'm about to crash and burn.
Right. That's my mantra. Things are always working out for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or things will work out for me in the end.
Yes.
Right? So I love that mindset. So my final question then, because of course you are a change maker, you are a rainmaker in all the ways, and this is a podcast about making it rain, and some of the ways that we have effected transformational change in our own lives through our own grit and determination. Can you share an example of when you've made it rain in your life? You've got many, many examples, but one that you are particularly proud of to share with the rainmakers?
I think for me, over the past 2 years, I have to give myself a pat on the back for what I have managed to balance. The things that have been on my plate in terms of work, in terms of managing my health. My mum was also not well for majority of last year. And within that, I still managed to create some incredible innovations. I'm in the final round of an accelerator at Imperial, and possibly starting a business from that. I have managed to balance and maintain relationships in my life, and I haven't been sick apart from that time in New York. And so I think all of that to me just feels like I am so blessed and I'm making it rain in that sense. I'm very grateful that I have given myself this opportunity to pivot, and I'm excited to know what will happen then, because I don't take things lightly. I am going to be pushing and building and continuing to thrive after I've had a couple of days sleep once my exhibition is done. But I think, yeah, I'm just grateful that I've navigated this pivot in the way that has felt aligned.
That's such a beautiful ending to this episode. And I particularly love that you said, I'm grateful to have given myself this opportunity to pivot. Mm. You have given yourself this opportunity to pivot, because there are opportunities out there but we have to empower ourselves first before anybody else can empower us. So Sam, thank you so much for that reminder. And thank you for your time here today. Where can people connect with you, follow your journey? I love your newsletter. Where can people get access to all the things?
So my website is samanthaand.co. And you can find me there. My Instagram is @samanthaand_. And on LinkedIn, I'm Samantha Clark. I mean, there's millions of us, so I think it might be Clark as well. But you'll find my LinkedIn from my website. And my book, brilliant. Love It or Leave It.
And of course, Love It or Leave It.
It's available on all good book platforms.
Samantha, thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you. Bye.
Hi everyone, Davinia here. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. If any of what you heard resonated and you'd like to find out more about how Raincheck is helping women all over the world build sustainable long-term wealth, then visit our website at raincheck.com and join the mailing list for more commentary, tips and opinion on how you can start taking steps to leveling up your financial well-being today. You can follow us on social media at Raincheck, and don't forget to share, like, rate, review and subscribe. See you next time.